Let's start with what's perhaps the second biggest casualty of the COVID-19 outbreak, deepening inequality within and between nations. Leaders now chant the mantra that, quote, we're all in this together. But it's mostly professionals who've been able to work from home, sometimes in splendid isolation. For the rest, who haven't lost their jobs, they still need to drive buses and clean offices and deliver products ordered online. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz is the author of the new book People, Power and Profits. He's also co-writer of an article in the British medical journal The Lancet about COVID-19 and the new inequality. Joseph Stiglitz joined me via Skype.
I'm in New York, and we are seeing the way that this nasty virus is not an equal opportunity virus. It goes after the people with poor health conditions, and that's disproportionately poor individuals. It's had ravishing effects on those parts of New York City, for instance, where there's lower income. It also makes those middle-income people, teachers like me, can go on with our work. I do my teaching through Zoom. But those who are on the front line delivering goods are exposed day after day to the COVID-19, and another reason why they're coming down with this disease at such a higher rate than others.
You point out in your article for The Lancet, which you co-authored, that these people are not merely the lowest paid in many societies, but they're also poorly treated on a general level. How is the coronavirus crisis exacerbating their sort of already poor treatment that they may receive in the workplace?
A good example is that employers are not providing them with protective gear. In a few instances where there are strong unions, they threaten to go on strike unless they had masks. But in most of America, unions are weak and they're forced to go to work exposed to the COVID-19 every day. A dramatic example is our healthcare workers, not the doctors, but a lot of the orderlies, the people who are helping out, are very exposed and dying at very high rates.
Who's going to pay Joe at the end of this, not simply in lives, but also in dollars? If we look at the response to the global financial crisis more than a decade ago, in places like the UK and parts of Europe, there were deep cuts to public health and public service budgets through austerity. And it wasn't the fault of teachers and nurses that we had a global financial crisis. Who do you think is going to pay for the coronavirus crisis?
Well, that's a battle that's going on right now in the United States, and I'm sure similar battles are going on in other countries, probably more vicious in the United States. The state and local governments are being absolutely hurt badly. Revenues are going down. In the 2008 crisis, tax revenues went down almost twice the declining GDP. Yet, the Republicans in the United States are fighting against giving any assistance to the states. Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican head in the Senate, says, let them go bankrupt. And of course, the states are the political unit that's responsible for education, for health, and for welfare payments. So they're going to be asked to bear the cost. The states in the United States, all of them have balanced budget frameworks, which means if the revenues are down, they can't run a deficit. They have to cut back on their expenditures. That's why it's so important for the federal government to give assistance. The shortfall is being estimated anywhere between $300 and $500 billion or more. That's a good example of the ways in which ordinary Americans are going to have to bear the brunt. Meanwhile, the data that is coming out on where the money is going, you know, we had a first tranche of assistance of $2.2 trillion US, and another tranche of almost $500 billion. As reports are coming in where that money is going, it's going disproportionately to the very wealthy large corporations. It seems like the administration is not able to get money to the small businesses, to the poor, more vulnerable American citizens.
Is there anyone out there, corporation or any sector of the economy, that is really cleaning up out of this, that's making money?
Well, Amazon is doing very well. Yes, they are cleaning up. The reason is people don't want to go to the store. They're locked up at home. And if they're not one of the very vulnerable people who are left without jobs, left without income, if they're one of the people at the better end of the distribution, they're spending their day ordering things, getting deliveries of absolutely everything.
Although I did notice in the New York Times that the growth of a company like Amazon and some of the other tech giants that seem to be prospering in this coronavirus crisis actually makes them more vulnerable in the sense that there is now a great deal more public attention on their awesome market power.
Well, there is actually a lot of attention on this for the pandemic. In my book, People, Power, and Profits, one of the main themes of that book was that the growth of market power in the United States is one of the major factors contributing to this enormous growth of inequality. And at the core of that growth in market power are the companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook. And it's not only the conventional market power, the kind that we're used to, but their ability to have our data and use that data to exploit us. So it's not only market power in the old sense, there's a whole new sense of market power, an ability to engage what economists call discriminatory pricing, making those who want the good pay more than others, often discriminating against poor people who have no choice because there are no stores near them. It's really something that is of increasing public concern, let alone to talk about privacy. So it was a concern before. It's going to be an even bigger concern now.
Let's talk briefly about your book, People, Power and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. In your economics, you've always looked for the more profound questions. One of the most profound questions you raise is you ask, what is the true source of wealth? Well, first of all, where do you see the true source of wealth? Is it Wall Street? Or is the true source of wealth now the doctors and the nurses who keep us healthy and the teachers and the janitors?
Exactly. Or let me put it a little bit more broadly. The reason we have a higher standard of living today than we did 250 years ago is because of advances in our understanding of nature, advances of science. And we're seeing that in the response to the pandemic. It was only because of advances of science that we could figure out why are people dying, identify this nasty virus, and then begin the work of developing retrovirals or vaccines. So it is the advances in knowledge and the people like the nurses and doctors who are using those advances in knowledge to increase our standards of living, to enable us to live longer, that really are the source of the wealth of nations. It's not the gambling casinos. It's not the people who have developed a lot of expertise in exploiting others. But that's quite different. And that's the distinction between those who are creating wealth for the nation as a whole and those who excel in taking that pie and grabbing more of it for themselves, what economists call rank seekers. And unfortunately, a very large fraction of those who have done very well have done well because they've been really good at rank seeking, at wealth grabbing, not at wealth creation.
Given the pandemic has shown the importance of collective community action and indeed, frankly, state action. One of the other things that you raise in the book is the idea of a new social contract, not exactly a carbon copy of FDR and the New Deal, but very much in the same spirit. Does the coronavirus crisis lend itself to the kind of new social contract that you're proposing in People, Power and Profits?
Absolutely. In fact, it is a really good illustration of exactly the kind of arguments that I put forward in the book, namely that we had lost our sense of balance between the market, the state, civil society. We had trusted in unfettered markets. In the United States, probably is the most extreme case, but Australia has had its variant of this. In the United States, we defunded the science establishment. We defunded the part of the government that's supposed to protect us against these kinds of diseases, the Centers for Disease Control. Under President Trump, they got rid of the office in the White House that was supposed to deal with pandemics. We turn to government when we have a crisis like this. But unfortunately, 40 years of denigrating the role of government meant that we didn't have the capacity to do it. At the same time, we exaggerated the powers of the private market. The private market in the United States was not able to produce tests, was not able to produce masks, was not able to produce the ventilators that we needed. Our economy, just like in 2008, was shown to be short-sighted. The way I've talked about it sometimes is we lacked resilience. We didn't put spare tires in our car, arguing that most of the time you don't need a spare tire, but when you have a flat tire, you really do need spare tires. And that's the way we ran our entire economy. And now we're paying a very high price for that.
Just finally, Joe, as a former chief economist of the World Bank, you are clearly not someone who is opposed to trade. But at the same time, your book raises real questions about the failures of globalization for, you know, the working class, not only in the developed world, but also in the developing world. The pandemic has shown that the world cannot necessarily rely on supply chains from limited sources, particularly China, when it came to personal protective gear for medical professionals. What opportunity does the coronavirus crisis offer to, if you like, rebalance the globalization agenda?
It's going to force us to rebalance the globalization agenda. The undiversified supply chains is an example of the kind of non-resilient economic system that we constructed, as was the 2008 financial crisis, where a crisis in the financial system in the United States morphed into a global financial crisis. But at the same time, let me emphasize the dangers of the kind of withdrawal from multilateralism that Trump has been advocating. He's talked about putting restraints on the exports of important medical supplies. But what he doesn't focus on is the fact that America imports far more than it exports. And if other countries reciprocated, we would be in a really difficult position. So what the pandemic emphasizes is that we share a planet in the same way that climate change emphasizes. We share one planet. We have to cooperate together in solving some of the very big problems that we face. The pandemic is one, climate change is another. So the kind of antagonistic America first or some other country first is going in exactly the wrong way. And some of the strongest responses to this have been through our multilateral institutions. No human institution is perfect, but they've done a fantastic job. The IMF, the WHO, World Bank, they've all stepped up in a way that has been absolutely essential for addressing the problem of this pandemic.
Joe Stiglitz, he's a professor of economics at Columbia University. Joe is an award-winning, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. His new book, People, Power and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for the Age of Discontent. Joe Stiglitz, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Been a real pleasure.